this week in the markets. Silver blasted higher while the technology-laden NASDAQ closed at over 8,000. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek. It's just a pleasure to be back with you on this September 28th, Season 13, Episode 663 edition. We have another two big top financial experts on the show. But first, you know, although Hurricane Florence, the storm at least, is long gone, the rescue efforts have only just begun. In fact, they've intensified as rainfall on the higher regions continues to plague the coastal areas with intense flooding. Thousands remain homeless without power, plus displaced pets need our help. The Red Cross sent out a message this evening to volunteers with a plea for new volunteers. It's super easy to sign up. You just watch a couple of videos. They send you a link. You get the ball rolling. So if you're inclined, you can do so online. On a more positive note, the founder of Trends Research Institute, Gerald Celente, returns with essential insights for savvy investors. His Globalnomic models indicate the 10-year bull stampede in U.S. shares might end soon. And he loves gold, which he thinks, like many of our guests, may have found a bottom around 1200 and 1450. Once that barrier is passed, that threshold eclipsed, well, the uptrend in the precious metals could resume. Then global financier and economic wizard Martin Armstrong from Armstrong Economics and subject of the Forecaster joins me with his latest market commentary. He thinks paper assets will eventually evaporate, making tangible goods, hint, hint, gold and silver, the go-to asset class. But unlike most of my guests, he thinks that U.S. shares could still have much further to climb in the months and years ahead. And I'd like to share a quick health tip with folks. I was informed by a medical researcher this week that salt and cholesterol are in no way correlated with hypertension. That's right. Maybe we've had it wrong all these decades that it's table salt that causes the trouble, which is typically comprised of one-third sodium, one-third sand, and it's that gritty sand that, although it's microscopic, it enters the arteries and causes tears and fissures along the way. That, in turn, is plugged by cholesterol, which, of course, can build up and constrict blood flow, i.e. hypertension. So the key they suggested was Himalayan and or Celtic salt for much better health, maybe helping folks avoid heart attacks and strokes. We've also heard of the epidemic of suicides among many young U.S. veterans. I believe I may have one small solution that might reduce this. If you know someone struggling, here's a friend for them that's always available 24/7. You can forward this link to any high-risk individuals. It's a super neat artificial intelligence called Zoe, created by Microsoft. People have truly become overly attached, you might even say, to this amazing program. In China, for instance, it's called Xiao Ice. It has simply taken the country by storm. So if you'd like the link, you can find it on the web pages here or gsr@hughes.net. I'll forward it to you or your friends. I highly recommend this, especially to seniors or people who live in remote areas or maybe struggling in a new town or at college or university, maybe struggling to find a new circle of hombres, compadres, and amigos. Plus, I'm still giving away the free silver bar to the first 10 new subscribers of the Alpha Stocks newsletter and a gold bar to 5 and 10-year subscribers. We've updated the link. Yes, they were wrong. Thank you for letting me know. They have been updated, so they're all functioning, should be working well this weekend. So if you've been on the sidelines or the link wasn't working, Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear report. The Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. To field your questions and comments, please jot it down or plug it right into your Android or iPhone, 641-715-3900. You'll want the mailbox number 514049. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector this week following the FOMC meeting where policymakers indicated a possible end to the rate hike cycle might occur as soon as next year. At Friday's closing bell, the yellow metal finished near break even off just $5 at $11.96, just below 1200 support. Silver picked up, though, 35 cents, closing at $14.71. And the XAU precious metal shares were off just 85 cents, about 1%, down to 65. But it was palladium ripped higher, $27, up over 270 from a 2-month low, on track to perhaps eclipse the price of gold. Its best price since January, buoyed by expectations of record automotive demand worldwide. And of course, palladium incredibly useful in catalytic converters as well as in other manufacturing uses. Plus, copper flew higher last week. It paused a bit this week. News that officials in China are still pushing the infrastructure boosting agenda. And we all know copper essential to infrastructure growth, in particular electricity production and transmission. Keep an eye on Rio Tinto, ticker RIO. It's back up above solid support and a major copper producer. Black gold, West Texas Intermediate crude up $2.50, 3.5%, possibly en route to 80, even 90, closed at 73.25 on Friday. And Bitcoin struggled a little more this week, off about 91 cents, 10% at 794. We've got to hold that 6,000 support. If 5,700 to 6,000 fails, you could be looking at 2 or 3,000. Moving on, the top story in the precious metals sector, gold prices rebounded on Friday from lows, but the greenback did hold price in check on the heels of the Federal Reserve Fed funds rate hike, quarter point. That was the third time this year, and they signaled that they're prepared to increase again in December. Officials removed the phrase accommodative, which suggests that the rate tightening cycle may be ending next year, as I mentioned. This is viewed as a gold positive. The two-day September FOMC meeting increased rates to 2.25, highest level since April of 2008, the heart of the Great Recession. All 9 voting members agreed with the rate hike on Wednesday, and the Fed offered guidance of possibly 4 more rate increases, though, by the end of 2019. So we'd see at least 1 more in December and possibly 3 more next year. In related economic news, the U.S. dollar benefited from reports that the GDP accelerated in the second quarter, its best pace in 4 years, according to the latest stats from the Bureau of Economic Analysis of the Department of Commerce. The final estimate of GDP growth, 4.2% in the second quarter, again, the best number in several years, and the third best since the Great Recession 10 years ago. National unemployment rate remains excellent at 3.9%, an 18-year low. In August, wages grew by about 3% on an annual basis, the best level since June of 2009, near the end of the Great Recession. Elsewhere, the Department of Commerce announced key durable goods moved higher by $11 billion in July to $260 billion, an increase of 4.5% on a monthly basis, twice the figure of analysts' forecasts, likely due in part to executives front-running the impending tariffs, which are essentially tax price increases that boost the cost of those key components they need to manufacture their goods. In related domestic economic news, the Department of Labor showed unemployment claims at the state level increased just slightly, a bit higher than expected, possibly due to the intense flooding from Hurricane Florence, which has temporarily displaced many workers. Yet even with the downtick, the U.S. economic numbers show some of the most solid manufacturing sector numbers and low unemployment in decades. Bottom line, precious metals, Bitcoin. It was silver that outperformed this week, along with palladium. This is obviously becoming a theme. It was copper last week, palladium, and now silver. Economic numbers favoring the increases in industrial demand from key manufacturing components, whereas compared to gold, which is primarily held as an inflation hedge. The holiday buying season is just around the corner, where bulls are hoping for stronger prices. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, partly sunny skies appeared over the New York Stock Exchange. U.S. equities posted mixed results on conflicting economic numbers as investors rotated away from key blue chips from last week into the high-flying tech sector. The 30-stock Dow Jones gave back just 285 of last week's 588-point gain, off just 1%. At 26,458. The S&P 500 gave back 16, ending at 29,13, 0.5%. Now, while the Nasdaq gained 59 points, about 1%, finishing at 80,46, just shy of a new all-time record. Turning to interesting shares in the news, from Zacks' top-rated list, it includes Nike, ticker NKE. It increased sharply. Plus Apple, a favorite Alpha Stocks pick. It remains a strong buy. Other shares include Aerojet Rocketdyne Holdings, ticker AJRD. It designs, develops, and manufactures aerospace and defense products, as well as systems in the U.S. Zacks' consensus estimate improved about 25% over the last 2 months. Plus Alcoa, ticker AA, remains a Zacks' top pick. It's a leader in bauxite, aluminum, and related products. Execs are calling for earnings growth of 40% for the current year, and Zacks sees it as a solid consensus estimate over the next 2 months. And Trinity Industries, TRN, looked solid and has a strong buy rating, but the last two, keep in mind, the charts suggest waiting perhaps a few weeks for a better entry point as momentum is starting to slow. U.S. shares bottom line. Well, just as forecasted in the last report, the high-flying tech shares moved in this secular rotation. Just another indication of a solid bull market in U.S. shares. The herd is nervous. The professionals are enjoying it, with corporate tax rates lowered from 35% down to 21%, and the administration still has plans to remove up to 75% of unnecessary regulations during its tenure. Investors just can't get enough of stocks in their portfolio. The 7 indicator greed to fear index pendulum did drop back to neutral, viewed as another positive sign from a contrarian viewpoint, and there just doesn't seem to be anything too frightening yet on the horizon. Shares may move higher. Blue skies ahead. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek. Joining us to share his insights on the market, Martin Armstrong, author of The Greatest Bull Market in History, Economic Confidence Model, founder of Princeton Economics, subject of the must-see movie, The Forecaster. How's the weather in Florida today, Martin?
Bright, sunny, nice, still snowing down south in New Zealand. So I've kind of picked a middle spot. Yeah, no, we didn't get any, the record heat that is hitting, hit the northern states and even Texas. I mean, so we never got any days that were even, I think the highest we had was like 93, 94 or something.
Hey, that's not bad at all for Florida.
No, I know. Everybody thinks, oh, Florida is much hotter. No, it's not. It's actually hotter up in New Jersey. I'm up by Tampa. You go down to Miami, it's very, very humid. And the same thing you get with in Tokyo in August. I mean, when I would work and just have to walk simply maybe 8 blocks to the office, they'd have to send a car to come pick me up, because if I walked it, by the time I got there, I needed a shower.
So what do you think of Tokyo? I mean, I've always heard the best things about living, if you can afford it.
It's kind of like being in the 50s in the sense that it's extremely polite. Nobody would ever steal anything from you. But you have to keep in mind that Tokyo itself was destroyed mostly in 1923 by the tsunami and the earthquake. So most of it is modern. If you want, to see the classical Japanese tower, type tiers of castles and things like that, you have to go to Kyoto or Nara or something like that. You don't really find that in Tokyo itself.
Exactly. Just don't upset your local Yakuza.
Well, yeah. Well, they tend to be more interested in going after the corporations where they get big money.
How long have you really been following the markets? I know you started off, trading, selling precious metals and coins and numismatics. But when did you just finally say, hey, I'm going to follow the markets? I'd like to know how many decades you've been doing this.
Basically, from the mid-70s. It started actually with the Franklin National Bank. One of my clients back then happened to be one of the executive vice presidents, and this was just starting into the floating exchange rate, the crisis there in the mid-70s. He called me in, he says, you understand all this trading stuff, maybe, I think we got a problem here. And they lost, basically the bank on 7% move in the Italian lira. They didn't teach this stuff. And they still don't teach it in school. I mean, I was asked if I would be interested in teaching it over at Cambridge University. And I said, excuse me? I said, don't think I really want to go teach class. I said, why are you asking me? And Because largely they have nobody in any of these universities teaching anything about the world economy. Floating exchange rates, they're still teaching all the old theories from Keynesianism and Bretton Woods. I mean, sorry, but we're not on a fixed exchange rate anymore.
Well, let's move on then to the Fed. Our favorite policymakers have obviously about 94% probabilities of raising rates to 2.25 this week, I guess Wednesday, September 26th. Dr. Copper picked up on that last week, up 8% in a single week. What do you think this means for the commodities sector?
Just basically following at this stage in the game, the real commodity cycle will probably kick in after 2020. But what we have to understand is, you know, what Janet Yellen was actually yelling about all the time, that we have to normalize interest rates. And people just don't get what that means. I mean, all your pension funds, et cetera, are going belly up because most of them needed 8% to break even. You got California looking to put in more taxes because CalPERS is below par. You have the same problem in Illinois, New Jersey. I mean, you name it, it's everywhere.
The thing about copper, though, is we tend to see it outperform much of the rest of the commodities index, the CRB, when economic conditions are robust. From what I've read now, we're seeing low stockpiles in China and increased demand. Do you think that might mean that conditions are a little stronger than people expect?
Well, you do have more or less the issue with commodities is that they are dominated in dollars. So as the dollar goes up, that also makes the commodities rise faster of their currency terms. So it creates the illusion of a bull market and inflation, but you have to understand the currency play. During the 1970s, I mean, I happen to like sports cars. I bought a Porsche in 1970 for like $20,000. By the time you got to 1980, that car was about a $60,000 car. And it created the image that, German cars are better, they appreciate, they hold their value, etc. And no, it was just the fact that the dollar was going down. They priced their cars in Deutschmark at the time. So the price kept rising. The way the Japanese beat the Germans in coming in with Toyotas, etc., they priced it in dollars and then took the currency risk home. So they were able to beat the Germans in the market. It's all a currency play. So as the dollar goes up, when you have commodities in dollars, what happens is it makes it look more like a bull market in China than it does in the United States.
The dollar had every opportunity from a technical perspective, the Fed about to raise rates and then again in December, and maybe a couple more times early next year, maybe not. There was quite a sell-off last week that I think may have injured its chance of making new highs in 2019. What do you think that means for the markets?
The dollar is still going to go up and make new highs into probably 2020, as late as 2021, and then turn. Honestly, in the 40 years I've been in this game, this is the worst I have ever seen it in my entire life. You usually have some political chaos in one place, and money moves to a quieter place. Right now, we've got chaos in absolutely everywhere. You go to Europe, you've got Italy, Greece, you've got Britain, looking at a hard exit. You've got the political nonsense going on here with Trump and really a deep state attempt at a coup. Everything is, there isn't a single place that's not going nuts. So it's not as easy as it was 20 years ago, honestly. The dollar is still just in the consolidation period. I don't see it as making any kind of a major decline. In order for it to decline, you'd have to have, say, all right, fine, it means confidence in Europe is going to rise, or Britain, or side the United States, and it's just not there. If anything, this is why the stock market's going up, because the real smart money and the big money is, they can't buy gold, 1 ounce bars and stuff like that. They can't do that. They basically, their only means of survival is the equity side.
So folks are earning higher relative rate between, let's just say, the yuan or the yen or the pound sterling. Obviously, the money flows are going to favor U.S. equities because the dividend is outstanding, pretty solid economic growth. Do you see that persisting for the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, largely this is the collapse in confidence in government. It's systemic. It's everywhere you look. It's more than just a debt crisis that we have. It is complete incompetence in managing the fiscal estate everywhere. You know, you get these people who are calling for hyperinflation because of the Fed, et cetera. They don't even understand what they're talking about. I mean, we are probably one of the largest institutional advisors. So it's the big money that we have to deal with. I can tell you what they were doing, okay? You had, fine, everybody's saying, oh, the Fed, $4 trillion, it's going to be, hyperinflation. Then you look at what did the Fed do? The banks complained, so they created excess reserves. And excess reserves went up to almost $3 trillion. Okay, so the money doesn't go out into the system. Plus, these ideas are so antiquated. It's absurd. The Fed, we're going to buy in 30-year bonds, and that will stimulate the economy. These are ideas from the 17th century.
Even with these much higher relative interest rates on the Fed, plus all of our QE, you look at their balance sheet over the St. Louis Fed, I mean, they're really curtailing now. They're down 5%. From the peak, the dollar should have had a more sustained rally, given the relative advantage we've had on a currency basis over the last, let's just say, 2 or 3 years. And the rest of them are starting to talk more dovish, at the ECB and the Bank of Japan and China. It seems like their currencies would gain against the U.S. dollar.
It's a question of confidence. I mean, there are a lot of rumblings behind the scenes here that you take the ECB, major institutions and political sources in Europe, they are screaming in both ears of Draghi that he's got to stop this quantitative easing stuff. He has completely destroyed the European bond market. There's just no bid. I mean, institutions they're not buying this stuff. They can't. How can a pension fund buy a 10-year bond and get even 2% or 3% when they need 8%? They're locking in a guaranteed loss. Nobody's doing this. All the European banks, or the ECB, what I meant by 17th century ideas. The ECB, we're going to punish banks, we're going to make them negative. If they put their cash here, we're going to charge them to do so. And that will force them to lend money out. No, what did they do? Yeah, they simply used their U.S. branch. They sent all the money over here to the U.S. branch, and the U.S. branch deposited at the Fed. Half of the top 10 banks I speak to personally did that. Politicians, they don't understand what they're doing. The same thing as we were saying with the Fed. We're going to buy in 30-year bonds. You're assuming only Americans own them. I mean, Japan, had them. I mean, China, they sold most of their 30-year bonds and brought the maturities down to 5 years or less. I mean, and then people, there was no hyperinflation. Because it's a very porous global economy. And the ECB could not enforce negative rates over there. The Fed could not stimulate the domestic economy because it's impossible because everything is basically porous on a global scale. So we just need completely new tools. The idea the central bank can actually manage the economy is absurd. And once the major players are confronted with that, you're going to see capital just run. You're looking at confidence in the government and paying attention to Fed numbers and stuff. It's going to collapse.
Where does it run to?
Right now, basically, you get into these periods historically where this time it's the governments that are in trouble. So you run away. Basically, you're not going to buy California debt, Illinois, New Jersey, and eventually you won't buy federal debt either. Then there are other times when the private sector's in trouble and the flight to quality is, you go to government bonds. So it's a cycle. I mean, and this time government has basically gone to the complete limits. That's it. It's absurd. I mean, my sources in Washington, the Democrats, what they want to do, they basically want to get rid of all the Republicans, and they feel they should raise the taxes back to 75%, where they were before all this nonsense with Reagan and Republican lowering taxes.
Well, you remember what happened then, right? I mean, there was capital flight out of the country. Everybody left.
Look, I mean, I told my staff, I said, if it ever gets to that point, I said, I quit. I'm not going to work as an economic slave for them. I'm just not going to do it.
We just heard last Monday that the administration is going to impose a 10% tariff on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports. That's going to increase to 25% by the end of this year. China, of course, retorted on Tuesday, saying they're targeting 5,000 products, about $60 billion, and that'll go into effect next week on that tax. Is this a game changer, or is this a big yawn from your perspective?
I mean, I agree with him on the lowering the taxes, etc., and what he has tried to do on trade, most of the press don't really give him any credit. But effectively what he has done in Europe, I know firsthand, they go, oh, you know, this is a trade war, you know. Well, he threatens to increase taxes. But then he comes back and says, hey, you drop everything and I'll drop everything. You know, and immediately the French go, well, no, we can't do that. So, you know, is he trying to basically raise the stakes to get to free trade? Perhaps. But, you know, tariffs and things of this nature only come back to create inflation, really, because they're just passed on to the consumer. So, and this whole idea of trade is kind of really, it stems from communism, honestly. It's all they care about and all they focus on, is the worker. All right. What about the consumer? You know, the consumer should be able to basically increase their lifestyle by, you know, you purchasing, you know, whatever it is, if it's a car or whatever, at the best possible price. You know, and look, New York City used to be all unions, and that was the biggest port for everything coming in. They got very dictatorial, abused their powers, and what happened? There isn't one ship that goes to New York anymore.
Last week, 600 points up on the Dow Jones, approaching 27,000. You went on record saying, hey, we could see 50,000. We could see 100,000 on the Dow if we keep running the way we are. Give us your latest take on why we're at new highs. Is the Dow just playing catch up with the high-tech, high-flying NASDAQ, or could this thing have legs?
You take the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P. Each one reflects a different category of buyers. When the Dow is leading, it's foreign capital coming in. The foreigner wants the blue chips. They're not going to go buy, you know, startup companies, and that's too risky for them. I mean, just look at when the Japanese came in. What did they buy in real estate? Rockefeller Center, you know. And Chinese do the same thing. They don't go down and, you know, to the local streets and buying housing for $150,000. They're not interested in that. They always want the trophies. And this is what the Dow is. It's the trophies to international capital. So when the Dow is leading all the way up, that's why I kept saying, listen, this is a international capital flows and they're coming into the United States, which is why the Dow was moving up. Now, you had the Dow making new highs, and now NASDAQ did not. The S&P finally just broke through. This is just a staging ground, and the Dow is probably going to go up to our next target around, you know, the high 30,000 area. I mean, there's a possibility we go all the way into like 2032. Now we're looking at, you know, the 60,000 area. But you have to take into consideration what is the dollar in purchasing power at that time.
Martin, did you mean 2022?
It can be as early as 2020 going into like 2022. That's the first period in time. Then the second one's out of the 2032. This was the first target for a potential temporary high in 2018. But now that we took out the January high, it's showing a lot more strength at this stage in the game. And this is all political uncertainty that's taking place globally. Where do you put your money at this stage? So if particularly, you know, these people like that are after Trump, they don't get it. They really don't get it. You're undermining the office of the president this is not a personal, thing that you get to, oh, I don't like him, so let's do whatever we can to get him out. You're talking about changing the foundation of the country. The President of the United States is supposed to be the leader of the free world. Okay, so if you undermine the president, regardless of who it is, all right, you are destabilizing the confidence in the United States globally. Everything will be okay, and we'll get it back to normal. It's not going back to normal. We crossed the Rubicon here. This is it. They don't even understand what's going on. You take the 28-year-old girl, Alexandra, in New York, who they said was the lion killer. She threw her hat in the ring and beat basically a Democrat who was there forever, and they thought he would be the head, the Speaker of the House if they won. Then they were shocked. So instead of saying this is still part of the Trump revolution, which is really just throw out whoever is in out against career politicians, they look at it and say, oh, the people want higher taxes and they want more socialism. That's why they voted for her. This is what's going on. So now the talk is, oh, we should raise taxes back to 75% because this is what the people want. Keeps it all together is confidence. The same thing if you look at, hyperinflation. They go, oh, it was increased in printing of money. That is the most absurd statement I have ever heard. Germany had a communist revolution in 1918. The other hyperinflation was Austria-Hungary. Hungary was the first communist socialist republic after Russia. And then you had Poland. So, excuse me, you've got money in a bank. You're now, and your country is going into a communist revolution as they did in Russia, and you think you're going to trust the government currency and bonds? I mean, it had nothing to do with printing money. The printing of the money comes as a result of the capital flight. It's not the other way around. And look at Venezuela. They got all the resources, all right? Venezuela's got the biggest oil reserves in the world. It's going through hyperinflation. Why? Because people don't trust the government. If you don't trust the government, it's all, that's the end of the game. So this undermining Trump is part of this process where what we're talking about here is undermining the confidence in governments globally.
Talk about undermining confidence. I mean, the Fed is now pulling back on that $100 billion per month monetary injection into our financial markets. They're taking the Kool-Aid, off the trading floors. Without that QE, what's going to maintain dollar hegemony?
Largely because the dollar is the only game in town. In Europe, the main reason the bunds were doing well is because it was to hedge against everything else. I mean, most of the European institutions were buying the bunds because it was a bet that the euro was going to break, and they thought they would get Deutschmarks. Others hedged their bet and sent it over into U.S. Treasuries. The dollar is still the only place for, you're talking about big capital now, where to park it. I mean, I think we're going to, it's this chaos that creates it. And it's only a rise in the dollar that will break this system, not a low in the dollar. If the dollar goes down, everybody's fat and happy. Emerging markets can issue more debt and more people will buy it. If you take the dollar up, what happens? They can't pay back their debts. You now have emerging market crisis, as we're seeing just as in Turkey, just for an example. That's what will break the monetary system. If you look at it, it was the dollar going up to all-time record highs, and that's why Roosevelt confiscated gold and he devalued the dollar. The dollar went up to all-time record highs again, 1985. What did they do? They had the Plaza Accord, created G5, and that's where the U.S. government and told Europe they had to create the euro. They needed competition to stop the dollar from going up. U.S. always wants a lower dollar. Europe always wanted a higher currency. So we're undermining the very foundation upon which everything exists, and that is basically governments and pensions and et cetera. Once that confidence is undermined and people begin to realize, hey, there isn't anybody really in charge, then it's Katie bar the door. Then I think we'll probably see some sort of monetary reform, another major crisis in that area. But to get to that, it has to be a higher dollar, not lower.
Just seems, though, with the Fed changing gears, 10 years almost of expansionary monetary policy, now to a contraction, there'd have to be some type of reverberation throughout the domestic economy as a result of that contraction in monetary growth and spending. And you seem to think, for the most part, we're the least sick patient in the ward.
True, but plus also that money was never getting into the economy.
Yeah, sitting on institutions' balance sheets.
Yeah, and you look at, excess reserves. I mean, just look at this. You're saying you want to stimulate the economy. Then the banks say, well, we don't have a place to put our money because we really don't want to lend it to anybody. So you create excess reserves, and we'll give it back to you. Oh, okay, that sounds good.
Do you see bubbles bursting, though? I mean, we've got that S&P Case-Shiller looks a lot more toppy than it did in 2006. As you said, equity is reaching record highs. This seems bubbly, but from your perspective, this thing can run on a lot longer than most people think.
If you look at it, all right, you have me on the show because I'm one of the two people that's been bullish. Virtually more than 90% of people out there, oh, it's going to crash, it's going to crash, it's going to crash. This is all they've been saying since it's this whole thing has started.
Not since 2009, to almost 10 years.
You know, this is the most hated bull market in history. When you reach a bubble, it's only when everybody flips and says, that's it, it's always going up. We haven't reached that point. And if you look at, you know, retail participation, it's still, you know, we are 50% below 2007 levels. Nobody's been buying us, per se, in that classic rush to the bubble type thing. Even if you look at, we have charts on our site, it's armstrongeconomics.com, of the P.E. ratio, all right, going back throughout history. Where is the peak? It's at the bottom in 2009. Why? Why would the P.E. ratio reach 120 at the bottom, not at the top? Because at that point in time, you don't know what's happening. So you basically just want to make sure that you get your money back, or as close to it as possible. That's why even T-bills will go slightly negative at the bottoms. You're willing to pay just to park your money. All this nonsense that, oh, the P.E. ratio, you know, the dot-com was 50. It was 120 at the bottom in 2009. Dot-com bubble was 50. We have a long way to go before you ever get to any historical highs on all that nonsense. And it gets to a point, the question is, do I just want my money back, or am I going to make a profit on this? We haven't gotten to that question yet. When that does come, and it's government that you're worried about bonds collapsing and who's going to be able to pay their debts, etc., then equities is the only place to go. For big money, I'm talking about. The individual, yeah, he could buy gold, etc., and, you know, and things of this nature. But the type of things that survive are tangible assets. Even if you look at Germany, when they had, you know, the hyperinflation was over and the new currency came out in 1925, what was it backed by? Real estate. They didn't even have any gold. So tangible assets are what survive. Real estate, that survived.
Exactly, but right now it's FOMO, fear of missing out, that's winning in the equities markets. And do you like for folks to have some diversification? Do you like the modicum of precious metals in their portfolio?
If you're talking about, you know, buying physical metals and keeping them, you know, basically in a shoebox or whatever, that's fine. All right, you're not trying to buy the high and sell the low. You have to understand that, you know, yes, some diversity is good, even at having some cash around, honestly. You know, you have Europe. I mean, people are stockpiling cash. They're not putting in the banks. The number one thing that everybody's buying is home safes. So you want to be able to definitely diversify to some degree, because you never know what the governments can do. And at the very end, they can always, you know, freeze accounts and things of this nature, brokers or whatever. So we're not at that stage yet. At that point in time, maybe you want to start looking at cashing some stuff out. But the main thing about the equity market, even the politicians are invested. The only time I get calls from politicians in Washington is when the stock market goes down. Real estate crash, etc. If you look at it, you can probably Google it. You'll see real estate did not decline in Washington, D.C. You know, it's a endless supply of employment money, so it's outside of the norm. So they walk around, they go, what are all these people complaining about? I'm fine. Let the stock market go down, then I get a phone call.
You love equities right now. Would you throw anything else into that portfolio?
I think, like you said, we're in a consolidation period where the markets are trying to come up with what to do. Just so much political chaos everywhere that it's like, well, gee, do I, if Trump's in trouble, do I go to Europe? Well, Europe's in trouble, so where do I go? Well, okay, Trudeau doesn't look so great over there in Canada. Britain's going through an exit. It's like, okay, where do I go? Bangladesh? So this is why things are choppy right now. Stock market may have reached a temporary peak, go back down for a couple weeks, you know, and back up again. I mean, this is what's going on. As we then we get closer into the November elections, then you're going to see all kinds of chaos. And what's happening there is just is very disheartening as well. I mean, all this stuff about Trump, you're basically saying democracy, who needs it? If it's against me, I don't like it. Kind of like Stalin said, you know, who cares about what you vote for? It's the people who count it that determine elections.
You know, we need a blockchain-based encrypted voting system.
They don't want to do that. I mean, well, then you'd actually have maybe a legitimate system. I mean, you know, Mark Twain, I thought, said it very, very best. He said if voting really mattered, they wouldn't let us do it. The hatred out there is just unprecedented. They'll have an election, but they're a little rigged and stuffing people that they want. I mean, you know, they don't understand what this Trump revolution is about. People didn't vote for Trump because they liked him personally. All right. They voted him in because they basically didn't like everybody else. And it's the same trend we're watching everywhere you go. Mexico, you know, over in Malaysia, they just threw out the president. It's happening everywhere. It's just an uprising because the way politicians have been running everything since World War II, it's pushed the envelope to the end. So it's not even a particular philosophy. I mean, if Mao comes to power on the other side, then you have FDR. So it's not even a philosophy. It's whoever is in, throw them out.
The traditional mantra in political circles is if the economy is pretty solid, if we can believe the numbers, unemployment at 10-year lows, pretty solid GDP, then it's the status quo, and it's the incumbents who stay in place. That wasn't the case this time.
Because a lot of other things are working here, and that is like pensions are not being, you know, being dishonored, etc. They keep raising the age limits on all sorts of things. It's just really a rigged game. Socialism is collapsing. And all the promises that they made are just being tweaked constantly. It's absurd. And it's hitting many people in many different areas. You had Hillary to get the her and Bill. Basically, they just had a sign on the White House, you know, for sale, highest bidder. So you had the bankers basically come in and say, all right, fine, I'll tell you what, we'll create the student loans that you want. However, you're going to eliminate any rights to go bankruptcy. So they say, oh, okay, fine, we'll do that. And then what do the bankers do? Then they come in and they want the parent to co-sign for the student loan. Now suddenly the bankers have a piece of the action on your house, and you can't even declare bankruptcy because it's a student loan. These are the things that are really disheartening. And yes, unemployment is low, and because it's hard to find good people, honestly. And at the same time, you have Forbes coming out and saying 65 or 60% of the students who graduate can't find a job. It's just the way it is.
As we wrap up, I understand you had a big meeting in Frankfurt. You had a seminar there. I hope that went well. And do you have anything else planned?
Yeah, our next one actually is our annual conference in Orlando. That's mid-November. They're kind of like mini UNs. I mean, there's more than $1 trillion in the room. I mean, people are flying in from all over the world. They're very interesting because you get to see the capital flows right then and there. They're very good. We have a cocktail party, so everybody gets to mingle.
Well, folks, put that on your calendar. You got to jot down Martin Armstrong's next seminar, November, Orlando, Florida, United States.
Yep, we do one in the home ground. We are international. Our clients are global, not just domestic. You can't look at just a single market. You can't.
Okay, any other contact information for the folks today?
Basically, our website, it's free. We do it as a public service, actually. It's armstrongeconomics.com. You can search countless topics.
Martin Armstrong, always a pleasure.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Top trends researcher, publisher, of course, of the Trends Journal, who joins us today. Welcome back, Gerald Salente.
Thanks for having me on. You know, there's a number of things going on, of course. Everyone's interested in where the markets are going and the geopolitical front. But it's interest rates. The United States interest rates are going up. I mean, they're back now to April 2008 highs. Eight rises since, 2015. And while the rest of the world is slowing down. So how are other economies going to do when you look at the global picture? And that's what we're looking at. So, for example, let's take currencies. You have, it's not only the Argentinian peso, what is it down, over 50% against the dollar this year, trying to stop the run on it. They have interest rates at 60%. You know, you go around the world, Turkey, their currency, India, their rupee is at an all-time low against the dollar. So the point being, the higher the interest rates go, the stronger the dollar gets, and the dollar is getting strong not because of the huge debt burden that we have in the United States, but because the other economies are so weak, so their currencies are going down. So the stronger the dollar goes, the lower their currencies go. And what do they have? Oh, about $63 trillion worth of debt in the emerging markets, and a lot of it's dollar-based. So the dollar gets stronger, their currencies get weaker, their debt load gets heavier. And so you're looking, for example, now in I mentioned India, and let's put this all together. And that's our system, by the way. It's called Globalnomic, making connections between different fields. And the other field to look at are oil prices. We're looking now at Brent crude back to 2014 levels, November 2014 levels. So what happens, I mentioned the rupee is at an all-time low against the dollar. And how much of their energy do they import? Oh, 80%. Okay, what is oil-based? Dollar-based. So they have to pay it in dollars, and their rupee's declining. So while we're seeing the United States economy doing relatively well because of the tax breaks, basically, the rest of the world is slowing down. And now with this rising oil prices and rising interest rates, if we're saying if oil hits $100 a barrel, you're going to see a not only an economic decline worldwide, but market crashes.
No, exactly. We've seen the Brent crude contracts head towards 100, and a lot of top analysts now are looking for triple digits in West Texas as well. We're looking at the potential for a flattening yield curve. That could invert as soon as 2019 as the Fed winds down its QE policies. The St. Louis Fed, you can clearly see the balance sheet contracting for the first time. Add to that the fact that we have the PBOC, the Bank of Japan, really starting to talk hawkish and give less dovish forward guidance on their plans for their economy. You know, I think the greenback has had it good for a while, and that's why I'm kind of surprised, and I know a lot of people were, by the big sell-off in the U.S. dollar last week, because with everything going for it, you'd think the dollar would be doing better than it is.
Well, on the precious metals front, you know, the dollar, going first with the dollar, I mean, nothing goes straight up or straight down when conditions are as they are now. They don't have a radical situation going on. Yeah, then they go right down. But we don't have that right now. So the dollar gained a lot of strength. The other ones lost a lot of power. But look what's going on. I mean, why are they gaining strength? They're raising interest rates in all of these countries, combat their declining currencies. So we only see that as a temporary against the dollar because their economies are weak. I mean, look what's going on in China. You know, you have investment in China now, in internal investment, infrastructure investment. It's down to 1992 levels. And you're looking at more state-operated businesses buying up more and more businesses to keep it going. It's not like we're looking at strong economic growth. And then we're looking at the, you mentioned a number of them, the European Central Bank. I mean, they're not expected to raise interest rates until maybe next summer. So the dollar is gaining strength because not because of the economy is doing so great, although, of course, we have a stronger economy than everyone else's, only because, again, because of the tax cuts that have juiced the equity markets and temporarily boosted the economy. But the other ones are doing much worse. So we're looking at, again, the we've been writing about this now. It was our top trend, actually, in 2018, a market shock mass murder. And what we were talking about, what's going to shock the markets, is war outbreaking in the Middle East, particularly going against Iran. And you hear Israel saying they're not going to allow Iran to stay in Syria? I mean, who are they to say that? And as we well know, a Russian plane just got shot down last week because the Syrian defense fired at incoming missiles being shot by Israeli planes and hit the Russian reconnaissance plane. And now Russia's putting missile systems, anti-missile systems, into Syria. Something that doesn't make the news at all, because we've got to talk about, you know, Me Too, this or that, and the Kavanaugh thing, and on and on and on, and that's all they do in America. They sell it in the media. No one's talking about the atrocity going on in Yemen. And where is Yemen located? Oh, yeah, that strategic point where all oil, so much oil flows out of the Middle East. So what we're looking at are escalating war, not only in talk, but in action. And if that happens, you're going to see oil prices spike and the global economy crash. Again, you're looking at currencies declining. Oil is dollar-based. They're going to have to pay more for less. So the United States is the only economy that's really showing any kind of strength. And again, it's artificially boosted. We're seeing gold prices going down now because of high interest rates. It's as simple as that. But we also, and we don't give financial advice, we believe gold is at its bottom. We gave the 1,200 mark. We said there, around thereabouts, and that's where it's been fluctuating around. But for gold is recognized as a safe haven asset. If you're a trader, that's one thing. If you're a long-time buyer, as I am, that's another thing.
War, you know, it's a necessary evil. But the funny thing about the war specter is when you let that genie out of its container, you know, you have that tendency for things to not go quite the way you anticipated. I mean, how many times have we heard, well, we thought this would be a 3-month conflict at most. Before you know it, it's 4 years or 6 years. And, you know, the whole world is involved. We're a very interconnected global community now. It's all interconnected through telecommunications. Leads me to the next question for you. With these trade barriers, i.e. taxes on imported and exported goods, China not terribly pleased with our actions. You know, most of my guests, they're much more polarized. Either they think this is a terrible idea, that tariffs will ultimately destroy global economies, or they believe that tariffs are necessary, could do the United States and the rest of the world some good. Where do you stand?
Well, I stand on, we're doing business. Let's just call it a business deal and begin it and end it with that. Am I going to do business with you if you're making a lot more money than I am and I'm losing money? And when we look at the whole tariff issue, we're talking peanuts here with China and the United States. Even at the worst scenario, you're looking, according to China, it's only going to affect their GDP at 0.7%. That's nothing. And again, look at the imbalance. So now let's put it into its context. I just mentioned about, you're looking at the rupee, for example, the Indian rupee. This is a major economy that is declined at all-time lows against the dollar. 80% of their energy is imported. Oil is dollar-based. What are they doing now? They're putting tariffs on imports. Oh, they're not alone in doing that. Indonesia's doing it. One country after another is doing it. They're putting tariffs on imports. It's being blown out of proportion. This is not a trade war. It's a renegotiation. And the reality is, I've been writing about this and talking about this, as it was happening back in the 90s, that NAFTA was only a benefit for the multinationals. And you look at the facts. What's our trade deficit with Mexico now? Yeah, about $71 billion. What was it before NAFTA? Yeah, we were running about equal. Again, we're talking merchandise trade deficit. $17 billion merchandise trade deficit with Canada. So these are going to be renegotiations. But what happens with the media, they put it at the extremes. The BS that every day markets are moving up and down. Why? Because of trade tariffs. Because of trade war fears. Oh, yeah? And the U.S. equity markets are up how much this year? About 9% S&P? So tell me then, every day the markets go up and down because of trade? No. The markets are moving because of economic fundamentals, P.E. ratios, earnings, GDP numbers, retail sales, purchasing manager index, etc.
On the one hand, we hear from our more seasoned economic analysts, if they believe it's really been stimulus by our Fed policymakers that has sustained this supposed economic miracle over the last decade. Without the balance sheet going to record levels, the longest period of ZIRP rates, obviously, in the history of modern economics, we wouldn't have seen those numbers you're pointing to, which are really the best unemployment figures in at least 17 years. That's the national unemployment rate, that is, at least. And then, of course, we're seeing some relatively strong GDP figures. So against that backdrop, if you look at a lot of the numbers coming through, I mean, we see Sears shutting down its doors, Radio Shack, just numerous retail behemoths across the board, malls closing down, and it seems to be going to the online arena with Amazon at the top of that heap. Do you really believe that retail sales are that strong?
Well, yeah, I'm in the camp of that there would be no recovery without zero interest rate, negative interest rate policy, and quantitative easing. You know, so no, it's a false economy. And as far as the retailers, you go back to our 1997, 1998 Trends Journal, and we wrote about dying brands in the new millennium. You know, these are all dying brands. Campbell's Soups. We warned all of them, by the way. We did major stories on this. They haven't reestablished their brands. Now, of course, as well, you're looking at a changing environment. The malls, of course, are dying. I wrote in my book, Trends 2000, a Warner book, national bestseller, in 1997, The Pall on the Malls, predicting that malls would be closing around the country, simply for two reasons, overbuilt and all the same. There used to be a thing called mom-and-pop stores and main streets where you had diversity of product. Different looks, different styles, different tastes. With the multinationals taking over and the big ones grabbing everything, it's all of the same everywhere. That's why you have the malls closing down. And that's why you have main streets, like up here in Colonial Kingston and other places, revitalized because of the uniqueness and the diversity. These are trends that you can see.
You know, there's another interesting component, I think, to the story. If you take a look at Amazon and online retailers, they have the narrowest margins. Why? Well, they don't have large overheads, transferring a big number of their costs to delivery services in today's online razor-sharp margin economy.
And that when you're looking at online sales, them being responsible for the pull on the malls in the retail sector, what percentage of e-commerce sales accounted for all of retail sales in the United States last year? Only 9%. And the number is only expected to reach 12.4% in 2020. So, yes, they're going to be grabbing a share, but it's really it's the lack of trend analysis, forecasting, inventiveness, and taking new directions by a very stagnant U.S. industry.
That 9% that you referred to, I would wager that's the higher-end product. It's not your tube of toothpaste. It's not your shampoo. It's not the items you'll pick up at a local grocery or a pharmacy or Walmart or Target or Costco. They're going to be the higher-ender, the laptop, the cell phones, the mobile phones, the iPads. We used to count on, the large department store that could either be freestanding, the Best Buy, you know, the CompUSA, things of that nature, and then, of course, the satellite department stores that held the malls together. Can you give us a few more thoughts as to why you're convinced we may have finally seen the ultimate nadir on gold and silver?
Well, it's the cost of production. What is it on average if you go from Peru? It costs about $1,200 an ounce to pull it out of the ground. So it's not going to go much lower than that. And again, we're also looking at what is the fundamental value of gold for so many people that buy it, and that's a safe haven asset. And what everyone knows that, you know, the market, I shouldn't say everyone knows, but there's a lot of speculation out there that the markets are well overvalued and over-leveraged, and this is going to come down at some point. And it's not only in the equity markets, real estate markets are also way overvalued. You're seeing also now people lowering their prices for the first time in years on a lot of both commercial and residential properties around the country, and particularly not only in the country. I mean, take a look what's going on in Australia as well, a very red-hot real estate market cooling down. And then again, you have rising interest rates that are going to be putting more and more pressure on that. So when you have extremely overvalued sectors, when they go down, they don't go down slowly. So that's why we're saying between the overvalued markets in real estate and the stocks and equities, with war drums beating louder in the Middle East, we're just saying gold has been and will be the ultimate safe haven. And we believe prices are, I've been saying this on your show, it has to be a couple of years now, that it's going to be around $1,200. And that's where it is. And that's where it's, you know, a couple of dollars below, a couple of dollars above. So we believe it's at the bottom. And the opportunity for it to rise, gold has to go over $1,475 an ounce. Well, $1,450, excuse me, for it to gain strength. And it hasn't done that in over 5 years. So those are the levels we're looking at.
This theme, as you say, or this trend in paper assets, you know, U.S. equities, the Dow hit another 138-year record high. There's some really compelling cases and arguments by some of our top folks that we could see much higher new highs ahead in those paper assets. They're chasing that capital gains. They're chasing the next top flyer, the next Netflix, Amazon, Microsoft, and many new names out of China. What's going to turn them on to gold and silver?
It's two different buyers. It's the ones for the long term, and it's the ones that are trading to make money short term. So you want to have, we're coming out with the New Trends Journal, and we're looking at our top trends. And one of the things we looked at, we call it Economic 9/11. And so when you have this scenario building, where you want to have security, that's what you're looking at. I don't buy a generator to use every day. I use it for when the lights go out, the electricity goes down, and I have it, gold, in this current market situation. If it was a different market situation, we'd say buy, buy, buy. And now we're saying buy and hold. And again, we're not giving financial advice. We're giving trend forecasts. So that's what we're looking at. And as far as the markets, we believe they're near the top. We believe they may go up a little bit more, but they're peaking. Because as interest rates go higher, that cheap money flow is going to slow down. And that's the reality of it. So you're looking at merger and acquisition activity at all-time high. The tax cuts that Trump gave, you saw what happened. You're looking at stock buybacks at $1 trillion this year estimated. There are over 800 billion now, and that's going to wear out. So we believe the peak is, we're at it.
What you'd probably advise people then to start thinking about overweighting, you know, some precious metals, maybe bonds as opposed to shares? Or are you looking like, you know, some of our more extremely bearish guests that this could be the top?
How could people ignore what's going on in the emerging markets? You're looking at the emerging markets indexes, they're in bear market territory. Look at the Shanghai Index, the Hang Seng, they're in bear market territory. They're down over 20%. I mentioned what's going on in India. Now they have tariffs on imports because they're afraid of where their economy is going. We see more danger ahead than positive growth. And again, we are definitely in the camp that the only reason why there has been any kind of equity market recovery is because of all the cheap money flow going in. And just to put it into perspective of the general economy, in the United States, since 2009, when the recovery began, 95% of the wealth went to the 1%. The rest of the people are struggling. So no, this is no great stock market rebound. And at some time, these schemes end. And we believe the end is nearer than the future of growth continuing.
When you enter a fiat system, when all the money, all the power, all the wealth accumulates, the top financial institutions, and in a tiny fraction of the top 1% of the elite. The reality is, sure, there's plenty of jobs, but you're earning on a real basis probably less than you were 20 or 30 years ago.
Oh, you absolutely are. There's no question about it. And the only reason why incomes are going up at any level at all is because people are working longer and have more jobs. Those are facts. And again, you follow the money. That's the name of the game. And right now, executives are selling off their company stock at record paces. We just saw in September that stock sales by company executives reached almost $6 billion, according to TrimTabs. And that's the highest September in a decade. And August was over $10 billion of insider sales. And that was also a 10-year record. So they know what's going on. This whole thing has been juiced by record stock buybacks and merger and acquisition activity at both of them at record highs. We're saying in this time, in this climate, that gold is a safe haven asset. Gerald Celente's GC's 3 G's, guns, gold, and a getaway plan. You know, and it's global. You know, somebody just bought Time Magazine. Yeah, Time Magazine. Last week's news tomorrow. The Trends Journal is tomorrow's news today. History before it happens. Money back guarantee. The new trend. It used to be a quarterly. Now it's a monthly. You will not find this information anywhere else. It's only $129 a year. Again, money back guarantee if you don't like it. TrendsResearch.com or TrendsJournal.com. And, you know, as I said, you know, I'm 71 now. You know, I try to do everything I can to stay loose. And thank you, Chris. And again, thank you for all that you do.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. Tremendous energy has been expended this week with Senate confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. The swamp was brought to a slow boil as senators, one by one, tried to appear as if they supported truth and justice, when in fact, all they supported was themselves, and their own shallow ambitions to appear righteous, as they pointed their fingers and raised their voices with indignation, all the while gathering sound bites and video clips for the next news cycle, party fundraiser, and especially their re-election. Many who watched these hearings felt sorry for the nominee. Others felt sorry for the accuser. But both of these individuals knew they were going to be on the chopping block. However, the Senate itself was on that same chopping block. Yet none of these distinguished men and women had a clue. For them, it was politics as usual. Weaponized politics. Regardless of what happens to Judge Kavanaugh or Dr. Ford, one or both of whom will become casualties of this process, the real, as of yet unacknowledged, casualty is the dinosaur status of many senators, whose careers will soon become extinct. If there was ever an argument for term limits, It was the performance and antics of senators who are clearly intoxicated with power and self-importance and do not know how to gracefully exit the room. One senator prefaced his comments by saying, "He's been in the Senate for 44 years. Others have been there 2 and 3 decades. Therein lies part of the problem. The quest for relevance will create its own form of attrition over the next few elections. Being complacent and out of touch is never a good thing, especially when you're on public display, and in particular, when you are the last to know or be told. I would suggest that many Senate staff members, out of their own quest for relevance, tell their senator what they want to hear instead of what they need to know. Now would be a good time to cancel your cable or satellite TV until after the elections, because guaranteed, all the rhetoric from the past week is being edited right now into one political and special interest TV ad after another, ad nauseum. Regardless of what decision the FBI makes when reviewing the case, it will be politicized. If the last-minute referral for a one-week review favors Judge Kavanaugh, the Democrats will cry foul, just like they did when Comey made his announcement about reopening the investigation into Hillary Clinton just before the 2016 presidential election. If the FBI report goes against Judge Kavanaugh, some Republicans will cry foul and advance the narrative the FBI remains highly politicized and requires further house cleaning. Meanwhile, President Trump should put Amy Coney Barrett on speed dial, because in my opinion, that was his true, real first choice. But the Supreme Court nominee will not be the only issue impacting the 2018 midterm elections. Just wait until the Obamacare price increases get announced in the coming weeks, and then you'll see all the rats really run for cover. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For 2 new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.